I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a conversation about identity and diversity. My guest is the New York Times bestselling author Irshad Manji, the founder of the Moral Courage Project in California. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Quoting sources from Bruce Lee to Ta-Nehisi Coates and drawing on her own experiences as a gay Muslim woman, she examines the rhetoric around diversity, and she calls for a new formulation for cultural and political discourse, an honest reckoning that shuns labeling people as a substitute for understanding them. Irshad Manji on identity, culture, and the way we talk about the values we hold. Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday. My guest today is Irshad Manji. She is the New York Times bestselling author of The Trouble with Islam Today. Her latest book is a persuasive and trenchant peroration on what for many is a sometimes amorphous subject, diversity. What do we mean when we say that diversity is our strength or that we should celebrate diversity? In the current climate, where political and cultural polarities seem to be as exacerbated as ever, fear and even vitriolic hatred of the other appears to be rampant. And it seems that it has pervaded the public square in increasingly pernicious ways. In her new book, Irshad Manji examines the rhetoric we use when discussing the other and how changing that rhetoric can lead to more understanding. She writes that, quote, diversity itself does not divide. It's what we do with diversity that splits societies apart. But she also observes that diversity is Americans' common denominator and that it can bring us together. The book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Irshad Manji joins me on the line from the studios of NPR in New York. Welcome.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
I'm delighted to get a chance to talk to you. Your book was impressive and confusing and wonderful and infuriating. And it was a great experience reading it. So I'm delighted to talk to you about it. And listeners, if you'd like to chime in, if you've read the book or if you want to know more about the book and have a conversation with Irshad Manji, our number 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org and our Twitter handle is @midday_WYPR. So if I could, let me start with talking about this notion of common denominator and diversity being a common denominator. That seems like an oxymoron. I mean, the whole notion of diversity is that it's uncommon. What do you mean?
Well, if we're looking strictly at diversity as a matter of people's skin color or religion or gender or sexuality, then diversity can, in fact, divide because it emphasizes differences. And moreover, these days, the way diversity gets practiced, it's not about wiping out a hierarchy of the, you know, old kind where white guys would be on top and everybody else would be below. Sadly, these days, diversity is practiced very often in a way where the hierarchy just gets flipped, where white guys are derided, they are insulted and mocked, and as if this is a solution, they're put at the bottom and everybody else gets to be on top. That is not a solution at all, and it's in that way that diversity can divide. But if we take a look at diversity in a more generous way, namely that it's not external markers that matter. First and foremost, diversity must include diversity of thought, of opinion, of perspective and viewpoint. When we lead with that idea of diversity, then we're also going to include historically marginalized people because, we, meaning historically marginalized people, will have had some different experiences than the traditional straight white guy. But if we emphasize diversity of viewpoint, we're not telling white guys, you don't matter. You still matter. It's just that everybody else does too now. So I think that this is a much healthier way, much more constructive way of building a diverse nation, and that is to start with the idea of diversity of viewpoint.
And you write that that's even sort of embedded in the Constitution, that the framers knew and recognized that diversity of opinion was going to be something that was going to be, for better or for worse, part and parcel of the American Republican experience, you know, meaning it, founding a republic.
Exactly right. In fact, I took my cues from a former Obama advisor by the name of Cass Sunstein, a legal scholar, who pointed out that unlike any other republic up to that point in history, the founders of this republic realized that the way to hold a pluralistic society together is not to impose one or another ideology on people, but rather it's to give, an airing to our disagreements. And so this was the countercultural genius of the founders, that in order to be a nation, we've got to be able to disagree with one another and do so with respect. And I'll say what respect means in just a moment. The point being that obviously the founders didn't live up to that ideal in many ways. And we as a country still don't live up to that ideal, but the point of having an ideal is to strive for it. So, you know, bring ourselves together by listening to the disagreements that we ourselves have with respect. And when I looked into the Latin root of the word respect, I realized something really important. Respect does not mean agree with. It simply means to respectate, meaning turn around and look again. Don't dismiss something, or somebody rather, simply because of the first impression you've got of them or the label that you'd like to stick on them right away. Turn around and look again and engage. And when you hear somebody's backstory, you'll realize that even if you still disagree with their conclusions, you'll realize that their conclusions come from an understandable place. And that is the first step to building a nation, is to build those relationships that allow people to express themselves fully and freely. And for those of us who care about diversity, to step back and listen, gaining information from what people are saying, and thereby reframing our own arguments in a way that they can finally hear.
Yeah, and when it comes to respectating people, you quote the philosopher George Yancey, a black philosopher, who says, "As a black, I am possessed by an essence that always precedes me. I am always known in advance." It's tricky business disassembling identity from, you know, the kind of racial, ethnic, gender identity that you referred to, from the argument, the viewpoint, the diversity of opinion. It's tough, isn't it?
Well, it's tough, and I'm not arguing that, you know, that race and ethnicity, class, and sexual identity and gender don't matter. What I'm saying is that there's so much more to any one of us than meets the eye. You know, in the book, I tell the story of two young people, Genesis and Lewis. Both of them grew up in Biloxi, Mississippi. Genesis is and I'm going to use labels here for the sake of, you know, making my point. Genesis is a biracial hip-hop artist. Lewis is a straight-up white guy. Genesis wants the Mississippi state flag to change, to have the slavery era symbolism removed from it, and to create a much more inclusive design. Lewis wants the flag to stay as is. For him, this is a part of his heritage. Instead of merely dismissing Lewis or rolling her eyes, snapping her fingers, and deciding he must be a racist, Genesis invites him to her backyard in order to hear where he's coming from. And she asks him, "How does the flag make you feel?" And because she asks him that question, he feels the need to ask her later on, "How does the flag make you feel?" And over the course of an afternoon, they have a constructive conversation about where each of them is at. At the end, what Lewis realizes is that even though he still wants the flag to stay as is, he realizes that he actually cares more about Genesis as a human being than he cares about the flag. And he winds up supporting her point of view and becoming one of the, you know, biggest advocates for a more inclusive design. That's the point I'm making, is that, you know, I'm not asking people who love diversity to be nice for the sake of being nice or polite or even civil. Much harm has been done under the banner of civility. What I'm saying is there's an ironclad psychological law that applies to all human beings, namely, if you want to be heard, you must first be willing to hear. That is the ironclad law that Genesis tapped into. And I think that for those of us who want a nation made up of all kinds of people, we have to be willing to hear those who are afraid of such a nation. And when we hear why they're afraid, we'll see not only are these people human beings, but that we've learned something about where they're coming from that can then lower their emotional defenses so that we ourselves can begin to make our points that in a way that includes their values, that speaks to their values, and that, as I said earlier, we have a shot at being heard using this approach.
Irshad Manji, the book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. I wonder, the example of Lewis and French is interesting. You also have a video of the conversation that they organized in Mississippi mm-hmm. about the flag, and we'll mm-hmm. post a link to that video. I'm interested that you thought it was constructive. I thought it was, certainly a constructive act to bring people together and to have them have that conversation. But I wonder what ultimately happened. I mean, what you're talking about and Lewis coming over to see Genesis's point of view on this is persuasion, you know? So, I mean, one of the opinions had to change in that conversation rather than two people just holding each other's very different views in mutual respect. I mean,
actually,
is it a matter
no.
What's the end game here? Do we need consensus all the time?
Tom, no. And I have to contest the premise that with which you just asked this question. Remember, in that first conversation, and just as I told in the story moments ago, Lewis did not change his mind. He still wanted the flag to stay as is. What he changed was his heart. Namely, he saw that because Genesis was willing to give him the space to express himself in a way that didn't, see her jumping down his throat, his emotional defenses lowered. And in that sense, he realized that, you know, if she's going to give me respect, turn around and look again, I've got to give her respect. In other words, moral reciprocity was what Genesis created as a result of the respect that she went into this conversation with. And so he did not change his mind about the flag. He changed his mind about what was more important. Was Genesis and her need to belong in this society more important than the flag itself? That's what Lewis concluded was what he cared more about.
Yeah.
And so we don't need consensus, not at all. What we need is for people to get a fair hearing. And the reason I say that those of us, and I'm among them, on the liberal/progressive end of the political spectrum are the ones who ought to go first in this regard, in the listening department, is that we are the ones who talk a good game about diversity. And right now, we're not really living up to what diversity can be. So in order to give the very idea of diversity some integrity, we're the ones who've got to open up our ears and allow people who disagree with us to be heard in relationship with us.
And when we come back from a break, we'll talk about the role that labels play, because you make a very compelling point about how so often those of us on the left, and I'm probably politically aligned with you, more so than for example, Donald Trump, and how we use labels as substitutes for actually understanding people. I think that's a really compelling point. We'll talk about that when we come back with Irshad Manji. The book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on the Arts. Darren Atwater, the artistic director of the Soulful Symphony, will join me to talk about his orchestra's new residency at Merriweather Post Pavilion. Blues legend Guy Davis will perform live here in Studio A in advance of his appearance at the Common Ground on the Hill Folk Festival. And theater critic J. Wynne Russick will review Steel Magnolias at the Spotlighters Theater. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is the New York Times bestselling author Irshad Manji. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWIPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWIPR. Irshad Manji, you call for an honest diversity. And you say that the advantages of cultivating honest diversity is that, number one, we'll wake up from the false certainty of labels, we'll sober up from the addictive tribal loyalties, and we'll grow up from the juvenile need for validation. I think those are three very compelling thoughts. What is the difference between honest diversity and what we're doing with diversity as it stands?
Yeah. So I think that we're more often than not in this society practicing what I call dishonest diversity. And that is labeling as a substitute for understanding. So, you know, we tend to count the number of African Americans in the room or LGBTQ people around us or, you know, women in positions of power. And we say to ourselves, okay, so we've got so many people, you know, there. Is that enough? It is. Great. We've got diversity. That, however, is dehumanizing. What labels do is they package people into sort of one slice of who any of us is. It's like we treat one another as commodities. You know, we want diversity in our workplaces simply because we think it's important to have, you know, more dark-skinned people or more women and so on and so forth. But we're not looking at people as individuals, as complex creatures in our own right. And so rather than commodifying individuals by, you know, wrapping them up in this or that label, I'm suggesting that we move beyond labels and we actually engage one another and hear where each other is coming from. And when we do, and I'll get back or hearken back to the story of Genesis and Lewis, which you and I discussed just before the break, we see that people, you know, can't easily be reduced. Lewis, for example, did not want the Mississippi state flag to change. And so it would be easy looking at his, you know, dusty ball cap or his red beard to say, well, obviously this guy is a redneck or he's a racist, a bigot. But when Genesis began speaking with him, she realized that he's actually a much deeper thinker than that. And at one point in the conversation, Lewis said, you know, even though the flag, the Mississippi state flag, is a symbol of my heritage, will I lose my heritage if we change that flag? The answer is no. My heritage lives in my heart. And what he said in those few words was that identity does not have to be zero sum. I don't have to win for, you don't have to lose for me to win. I don't have to lose for you to win. We can actually work towards a society in which if it's not win-win, then at least one of us wins without the other having to lose face. That's a deep thought. And this from a guy who calls himself a garbage man because he installs trash compactors, you know? So that is what I consider to be honest diversity, is to peer beneath the surface and to actually engage and learn something about the other. If I can get a little bit Kennedy-esque about this, even as an activist, if you're looking to bring some holdouts on side, whatever the issue is, ask not what you can do to change their mind. Ask what you are missing about the holdouts.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that we're missing a lot when we are starting with labels, and you advocate to view these labels as starting points, not as finish lines. And that makes a lot of sense. But I wonder, is that a kind of a unilateral abandonment of labels? I mean, Chief Justice Roberts in the Supreme Court, when they gutted the Voting Rights Act, basically said something similar to that, in that we need to understand individuals as individuals, and basically racism doesn't exist anymore, so we don't need provisions in the Voting Rights Act that require federal jurisdiction over voting regulations in certain states. And there's an awful lot of people who say, well, look, you know, racism is still a very real thing, and mm-hmm. we do need those, do need that federal oversight. But so at some point, there are values to labels up to a certain point, are there not?
Of course. And again, you compare rather provocatively, I would add, what I'm saying to, you know, Chief Justice Roberts' argument that we don't need, we can gut the Voting Rights Act because racism doesn't exist anymore. BS. Of course racism exists. We all know it. And I'm not here to say that by knowing one another as individuals, that alone can solve the issue of racism. What I'm saying, though, is that when we make ourselves more human to the people who would other us, the people who would reduce us to the label black or the label Muslim or the label queer or whatever it may be, when we are the ones to allow our complexity to show through, they have a greater incentive to then recognize that the way in which they are reducing us does not make sense. And if anybody who's listening today thinks, oh, how naive, I can only say that what I write in Don't Label Me is backed up by study upon study upon study, research and data. And it's because we as human beings tend to think much more emotionally than we do rationally, that even those of us who want diversity tend to, especially in the Trump era, assume that nothing we can do on our own will reduce and eliminate racism. I'm saying take a breath, slow the blood rush in the body, and recognize that when we are creating relationships with people who would otherwise see us as mascots of one or another tribe, we're giving them a reason to see us as fully human. And by the way, that is how the LGBTQ movement succeeded.
Yeah, it's an excellent
example. I would suggest that the Black Lives Matter movement, an important movement, and one whose goals of ending police brutality against all people, including black people, I would suggest that they try that approach. Anything less is, in fact, to drive a wedge between human beings.
The book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. My guest is Irshad Manji. It's midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @midday_WYPR. Let's go to the phones to Sam in Baltimore. Sam, welcome to Midday with Irshad Manji.
Hey, thanks. So My question is, I'm a liberal progressive, much like you, but I get this sense that there's an underlying premise to the maybe the book and the discussion that's being had, that if conservatives listen to liberals and progressives, they'll be convinced. And I'm just wondering that this has to be a two-way street, because there's no way that us liberals and progressives are right about everything. So I guess my question boils down to whether this goes both ways.
Absolutely, it goes both ways. How can it not? That's what a relationship is. But what I'm pointing out is that if you value diversity and pluralism and inclusion, as many liberals and progressives, forgive the labels, do, then it is up to us to be the ones to go first in the reconciliation department. Because of the way we are wired as human beings, we will, of course, operate in us and them terms. We have an ancient part of the brain that is constantly seeking out threats. The problem with this ancient part of the brain is that it works well in life and death situations, you know, when we have to fight or flee. That's great. That's when the ancient part of the brain is our best friend. But it ceases to be a friend when we're merely being disagreed with. This ancient part of the brain cannot distinguish between mere disagreement and mortal danger. And so it's up to us to outwit our brains. And I give examples in the book of how that can happen. But back to the point then, you know, is it a two-way street? You bet. And what I'm saying is that by going first in the listening department, just as Genesis did with Lewis, we set the table for the emotional defenses on the other side to lower. And ultimately, we create a situation of moral reciprocity where the other does feel obliged to listen to where we're coming from, but not until we have given them a fair hearing. Now, does that work in every situation? Of course not. Sometimes, as I explain in the book, you really do have to walk away. The world is crawling with conspiracy theorists who by dint of being conspiracy theorists, cannot be reasoned with. It's crawling with certified psychopaths and old-fashioned bullies. Here's the point, though. You don't know who's who if you walk away prematurely. And if Genesis had walked away from Lewis too soon, she would have left change on the table. That is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and you make a compelling point about not only is there a lack of understanding, but so much public discourse is premised in ad hominem attacks. You have a chapter called Humiliation Nation. Mm-hmm. And we're saying to white guys, and I'm part of that label, an older white guy, that they don't deserve the very understanding that you expect them to show for us, meaning those on the progressive side. Mm-hmm. So the makings of humiliation, humiliation radicalizes. So for the progressives to humiliate and look down upon a Trump voter can add to the proclivity for radicalization of that sector.
That's exactly right. Ever since the election of 2016, a debate has raged about, you know, why did so much of the country, or enough of the country, I should say, turn towards Trump? And some have said it's because, you know, the lives of working class people have been blighted by globalization. And while that's to some degree true, there is much more research to suggest that it is cultural anxiety. Now, again, a number of people on the liberal progressive side of politics would say, aha, that's racism. But I'm arguing, wait a minute. You know, it may be some people who have cultural anxiety are bigots, no doubt. But how dare we assume that most people are, or even all people are? And here's why I say that. It may very well be that the way in which, liberals and progressives over the last 20, 30 years have been throwing labels like racist, misogynist, homophobe, now transphobe, onto honest and decent people in the heartland, in the, Midwest, in the South, people whom we do not know personally, people whom often we have not even met, when they are consistently derided with those labels, it is easy to feel a sense of humiliation and therefore lash back and say, if that's what you think of us, then that is exactly what we'll give you. And I've made the argument in the book that that is where a lot of Trump supporters are coming from, so that they need to heal in part because of what we have done to them and their demographic over the last many years. Listen, it doesn't sail over my head, the irony of what I'm saying. Of course, many people in those parts of the country have discriminated against people of color and LGBTQ people and so forth. Of course they have. But let me ask the listeners this. Why is it that if they've done that to us and we've said that's wrong, why do we assume that it's okay when we do it to them? In other words, is payback really progress?
That's a fair point, absolutely fair point. But I wonder, at what point do we hold those voters, those non-racist voters? You say, as many have said before you, that not everybody on the alt-right or not everybody in the Trump camp, this base that we hear so much about all the time, is a member of the alt-right. At what point do we hold them culpable for associating with people who are in the alt-right, who do hold deeply seated racist views? The crowd in Charlottesville, Virginia. At what point do we hold them culpable for, if they in fact are much more moderate in their philosophy and their views? There's an association with racism and bigotry and intolerance that at some point has to be called out, right?
Indeed, it has to be, pointed out. The word called out, however, is what I want to seize on in your question, because again, it's the way we're pointing out this association that I think makes people who are Trump supporters that much more defensive and dig in their proverbial heels, that much more deeply. When we mock and insult and berate, you can understand why people would say to themselves, if this is your idea of social justice, I want no part of it. So rather than calling out, how about asking questions? How about asking questions like, I'm asking sincerely, not sarcastically. Do you ever feel, troubled by the fact that some people on your side of the political spectrum hold views that I'm pretty sure you believe are abhorrent? It's asking questions, and again, this is key, out of sincerity, not sarcasm, that will allow people who are swing voters, who did vote for Trump in 2016 out of a sense of humiliation, but who don't share his values ultimately. It's in the asking of the question sincerely, not sarcastically, that will create an environment in which they can begin to reflect for themselves, is this really, who I am and where I want my country to be? And if all we're doing is sort of posing gotcha questions, then this becomes nothing more than a game of win-lose. And in that case, we wind up playing the zero-sum game.
Yeah, you're back to the zero-sum dilemma.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right, which is, I'm going to lose so that you can win. Well, I'm not going to allow that to happen. Therefore, I will hold, I will stand my ground no matter how illogical it is, simply because I don't want you to win. That's a situation known as negative polarization, where you don't so much believe in your own position, but you are contemptuous of the way the other holds their position. And that is what we, who want to defeat both Trump and Trumpism, that is where we are missing a golden opportunity, to change the dynamic.
We have to take a quick break, but before we do, let's see if we can get to one more call to John in Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday with Irshad Manji.
Hi. So, my question has been answered already, and I've been trying to reform a new one as the conversation continues, and I keep having to reform it. I was originally concerned, but not the hypocrisy, but sort of like, why should we entertain people like Lewis if by the end of the conversation he's going to still hold fast to his beliefs that the flag is a symbol he wants to keep? But then you went and addressed that. So now I guess my question is, I am a big proponent of like the drop in a bucket causing the flood idea, but do we have time for all of these drop in a bucket acts to happen in order to cause that flood? Do we have the means to do that just on like I said, in terms of time?
Yeah, relationships are interpersonal, and you know, you can't know everybody. Yeah, that's an interesting point.
No, that's exactly right. And in fact, in the book, I suggest, as I will now, that as we hurdle to 2020 and the election in November of that year, as each one of us, and I realize this is not going to happen with each one of our listeners today, but that if you really care about preserving the progress that we as a nation have made over the last 20, 30 years by way of social justice, and making more progress, then take the time to develop a relationship with just one person, just one, who profoundly disagrees with you on something that you're passionate about. And when you do that, not only do you now have a chance of having them hear what you wish more of them would hear, but also you're going to learn something about why they believe what they believe, and at the very least, being able to reformulate your own ideas, your own points, in a way that speaks to their values will make you an infinitely better communicator for your cause than you were beforehand. In terms of, you know, like I'm saying that if enough of us did that, this would make a solid difference for reasons that I explain and don't label me. But the real question is then, what's the alternative? What's the alternative? To, quote, crush the other side? Guess what? You've just set yourself up for yet another backlash.
Yeah, and there are those who advocate that very thing. We'll talk a little bit more about that on the other side of the break. Irshad Manji, her latest book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. We will continue this incredible conversation after we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Irshad Manji. She is gay. She is Muslim. And those are labels that, while factual, don't begin, of course, to describe the totality of who she is. And while some might use those labels to celebrate her, others might use them as a cudgel against her. In her new book, Irshad Manji makes a compelling argument that those of us who say we value diversity need to change the way we talk about it. She argues that the proponents of diversity do a lot to advance polarization in our politics by shaming not only people who are authentically racist, but also people who have an honest disagreement with us. Irshad Manji is the founder of the Moral Courage Project at the University of Southern California. Her new book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. We'll try to get to a few more calls and comments. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR. And to follow me on Twitter, it's @TomHallWYPR. So Irshad, we have an email from Dan about a label we hear a lot. He says, can you address the trend of shutting down all discussion of important subjects by labeling what others have to say as hate speech?
Yeah. I don't deny that some speech comes from a place of hate. And in the book, I grapple with where to draw the line. But I am much more a proponent of free speech and the idea that it is only when we allow speech to be fully, you know, expressed that we can combat it in ways that are sassy, in ways that are feisty, and in ways that show that there are methods of using words so that they empower and not merely hurt. The idea, for example, of the of white nationalists marching in Charlottesville, Virginia, many of them were carrying weapons. And many of the people who came in to defend them were fully armed. That's when I knew that these people weren't interested in defending free speech at all, because they were brandishing weapons in ways that scared people away. In other words, making a show of it. So that's when you know that these people are hypocrites. And I love free speech enough to say they should not be tolerated, not because their ideas are offensive, but because they themselves are not playing, on equal terms, by which I mean wanting to defend, you know, free speech. So I say, you know, shut them down. But in the book, I also tell the story of a white nationalist who was outed at a campus, university that he was attending. And it was Jewish students who invited him to Friday night Seder, and over the course of a year, listened to his arguments, pushed back on them, but in a way that showed friendship and care rather than shunning and shaming.
Yeah, and he was eventually persuaded. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. And it was through those relationships that he realized not only is his information factually incorrect, but that it hurts people he will never, ever meet. That is when he knew that he needed to change his ways. And today, he's one of the most outspoken anti-racists in the country.
We have a tweet from a listener named Annette, if I could just jump in here for a second, because she's kind of on point. She says, as a liberal who's grown up in Maryland, I'm aware of my own views and am more sensitive to excising items that might be negative towards others who are different. But why don't conservatives admit their views? I'm floored when I hear them say they are not prejudiced in the least. People talk about implicit bias, and we all, harbor those things. It's an interesting point. And Caroline says, there's a fine line between what you're saying and victim blaming. Calling out racism does not cause or justify it. How do you respond to Caroline's point?
I would argue that I think that we are increasingly steeped in a culture of presumed victimhood, that when somebody says something that I find mildly offensive, that somehow I'm a victim. Now, is that to say that people who are on the receiving end of police brutality are not victims? Yes, they are. And these are important issues to address. But again, I want to be very clear. We need to address them in a way that can be heard. And you don't do that by rolling your eyes and walking away, or, shouting at the other that you just don't get it, that you have prejudices and you're not willing to admit them, and so on and so forth. Because that is precisely the wrong way of having them lower their emotional defenses.
Sure.
So, right. So again,
yeah,
style
is everything. Style and substance are two different things. Yeah.
Right. And I say, and we have the substance, but we don't have the style as people who embrace diversity. So I say to Annette and to Caroline, remember that being defensive does not make you effective. You mentioned Bruce Lee at the top of this episode, Tom, and he would teach his students, be like water. You know, water always gets to where it needs to go, not by making the rocks disappear or wishing them away, but by washing over them, gliding around them, seeping through them. And that is the kind of style that I think is what we need to adopt in order to move the country forward.
Let's try to get another call here, which I think is probably going to want to make that point. David in Baltimore, you've been patient, and I appreciate it. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for the call and to the guest. So what I struggle with when I'm talking with more conservative-leaning people is I have an expectation that they kind of have a basic understanding of their own kind of ideology. So one example is I spend a lot of time, as an example, explaining to conservatives that the tax spending we did, barring that $1 trillion unfunded that our children and grandchildren will pay back, is not being fiscally responsible. Right. Or I spend a lot of time when they say small government, saying that massively expanding government to, I guess, monitor women's genitals is an expansion of government. It's against their own values. So this bar is constantly moving. And what do you do when the people you're talking to that have this strong ideology about these strong belief systems but don't even necessarily understand it? And I spend most of my time just explaining their own ideology to them.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's one of the big problems with political discourse now is that the facts can't be stipulated to. People don't even, discuss a commonly held set of assumptions about climate change or any number of other subjects. Yeah, it's a good point.
But here's what I would say. I don't assume that people who label themselves conservative or libertarian or, on the right, have a consensus about what they mean by that. In other words, when you're entering a conversation with somebody who calls him or herself a conservative, you can't assume that that person is the stereotypical conservative that you have in your mind. That is why I say, whatever the labels they apply to themselves, get to know them, or at least one person who applies that label to him or herself, as a human being. And really, ask them questions based on what you've heard, not on what you think they ought to know as somebody who represents, quote unquote, that tribe. That is when you can get personal, when you can get intimate, when you show that you're actually listening to them as an individual and not as an avatar of some group, that is when the trust develops, and they will realize, just as Lewis did, that you care about them and where they're coming from rather than where Tucker Carlson or Sean Hannity is coming from.
We just have a minute or so left, but I want to ask your take on the incident with Joe Biden last week, in which he was hopped on by a number of people on the left, including a couple of people running with him, against him for the Democratic nomination for president, when he talked about the legislative process and how he had to get along with people like James O. Eastland, who was, in fact, a racist. He used the term boy in a comment that he used to describe his interaction with Mr. Eastland. What do you think happened there?
Sure. Look, I understand what Joe Biden was trying to say, and I actually embrace what he was trying to say, that in any grouping of people where there are different ideologies, you're going to have to figure out how to work together on the things that matter. So I embrace the spirit that he was trying to convey. His track record, however, on the things that matter, I don't think is, I think is problematic. And so whatever he worked on with segregationists, that's not what, would stop me from voting for him. What would stop me is that I don't think that he is bold enough, to move the country in the direction that I would argue the country needs to be. And so, kudos to Joe for wanting bipartisanship. I am all for that. But my kudos stop at what he has actually done with people with whom he profoundly disagrees. And that, I think, is a worthy distinction to make.
Irshad Manji, her latest book is called Don't Label Me, An Incredible Conversation for Divided Times. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Irshad, this has really been a fascinating and fun conversation. I very much appreciate it. And congratulations on the book, and thanks for your time today.
Right back at you, Tom, and to all of your listeners.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on the Arts. Darren Atwater of the Soulful Symphony joins me, along with blues master Guy Davis and Walt Michael of the Common Ground on the Hill Festival. And we'll have a review from our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. That's on the way tomorrow here on Midday. Special thanks to Well Crafted Kitchen for our delicious lunch today. Well Crafted Kitchen, located within the tap room at Union Craft Brewing, has a mission of celebrating community through a shared local food experience. Sourcing ingredients from their favorite Baltimore area makers and producers, Well Crafted serves seasonally inspired wood-fired pizzas and eats. You can join them for a shared meal at 1700 West 41st Street, or let them fire up your next celebration with their 1949 Mobile Pizza Kitchen. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.